for in my life, which just makes internal combustion a whole new world for me. I've enjoyed a state of laryngitis and sore throat for maybe about 2 days now. The point I thought when I rang Steve at 7:30 this morning, I got mumps. I was trying to convince myself you go and get mumps twice, but maybe that's not the case. So my bullfrog impression is now subsiding slightly. What I've attempted to do is actually to try and avoid talking too much because my voice will actually go. I've put some of my thoughts and my points down on acetates. The screen isn't very big, so if I put an acetate up, perhaps you'd like to adjust your seating, because for the most part I'll have to talk through these things as we go along. I'm very disappointed not to have been here during the day to listen to Jill and to Don and Anna. And I hope that the material that I'm presenting now isn't going to be too much of a duplication. I would like to think that maybe I'm thinking along the same lines as everyone else. I came into the work of caring for people and their families who had had or had cancer. I think at the beginning of my nurse training, I can't remember a time when I haven't been aware of somebody with cancer and the effects that that disease process can have, the joys of recovery and the fulfillment of relived and revitalized life that it can bring. And certainly when I was working as a ward sister on a ward that cared predominantly for people with cancers of various sorts, I think the first thing that struck me was the amount of enormous energy and strength and of courage that people showed, despite at times very unpleasant and very invasive methods of management and treatment. And that was the one thing when I felt despair about all this awful thing that was happening, the one thing that kept me going and made me want to just stay there all the time. It's been about 5 years now that I've worked for the Macmillan Cancer Relief Fund. Teaching primarily is my main employment, but on occasion still being able to work with people and families in my nursing capacity. My philosophy towards cancer, I believe now, is one of looking forward and realising that we all have a power and a capacity to re-empower people once disease has altered and taken their bodies out of a state of harmony and balance. And this is what I'm hoping to bring forward during this time with you now. I was going to refer to Roy's adaptation model of nursing, but realising that within the audience there are other people other than nurses, I felt it might be perhaps a little bit more interesting to look perhaps more from a universal or a generic point of view rather than focusing on a specific nursing philosophy. I was very much influenced by the work of a psychologist, Susan Lepedevin. And perhaps some of her teachings helped me to start to realign my thinking about how we can start to help and support when people are facing adjustments to serious and often life-threatening disease. And have started to think in terms by including this title of adjustments to loss and to change, or to change and to loss. Because I think that's an important thing for us to start to recognise. But once we are aware of a disease, disease process, we automatically have to start to reason out, what is it I'm losing as a result of this, and equally, what is it I'm gaining, and how am I going to redress the balance to bring those two into a more harmonious lifestyle, so that the quality and the quantity of the life is not adversely affected. My belief is that if we help appropriately and avoid over-intervention, that happily this realignment, this rebalancing will be met with a satisfactory adaptation. Because I believe that we are just working towards a fulfillment of potential. We are all born with a natural innate potential, and we all have an acquired potential. And sometimes these potentials are compromised. But that doesn't mean to say we have to give them up. I would also ask, as professional workers, what our involvement is. And I wonder at times how successful professional worker intervention is, if we do it excluding other people who are important to the person who is facing the adaptation. And maybe on my cynical moments, my definition of a professional is one who interferes in the life of someone else. But you'll forgive me for that today. I see the point of entry into people's lives when they have cancer as maybe coming into five categories. The point where we get involved during the early days, when screening procedures may be being undertaken because perhaps changes of the body have been noticed, or as a result of a routine preventative screening, and the associated alarming changes that can arise when perhaps suspicions or question marks are put behind someone's entry into self-testing. The next time we can become involved is at the point where the diagnosis is confirmed and all that that means at that time. My belief around this time or this stage of adaptation is that very often we are not sufficiently, as professional people, aware of how much time someone may need to have in order to come to some conclusion or decision about the management and the treatment and the future. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on. The next time that we can become involved is at the point of active treatment, whatever that might be. And at times, the almost viciousness of these treatments. Another time can be following treatment, where the person is then subsequently moving into a state of recovery, or maybe needs to go on for further follow-up, further screening, and possibly further treatment in the future. They've reached a point of many directions that can be taken. So maybe we should be asking ourselves, are the problem areas in any of those areas when we're trying to involve ourselves and offer professional services and opinion? And secondly, at any stage along that road, how can the caring and the curing be put onto equal footings? Perhaps at times I believe at times that the curing sometimes can certainly overshadow and eclipse the caring. And although I'm not suggesting people don't care when they're curing, it's the way that they're curing that perhaps at times doesn't always embrace the total concept of care. More than that, I believe that once the diagnosis is made of cancer, we're actually moving straight away into a state of rehabilitation. We're moving into rehabit formation. And at the same time, offering maximization of potential, if we choose to take up that challenge at that time. Because for the person, what they're going through is a point of transition. And that transition comes in the form of a time when the past is left behind, but the future hasn't actually yet begun. And that in this transitional stage, they're almost in a state of limbo. And this is when I believe we really need to start to show our care and our concern. It's also about the acceptance and the changing of an identity and a status, and realizing that the person we were yesterday is different to the person we are today. But that doesn't mean to say that this person of today cannot be all the things that we have hoped for in the past. Maybe just how we take that journey is slightly different. It was Galileo who said that you cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him to find it within himself. And maybe sometimes we forget that. And I think that if we are in the business of caring, I think the only way we can help that man to find himself is through a team approach. It cannot be done in isolation. There is no one more important than anyone else. I have got an abridged description or definition of a team approach by Dr. Colin Murray-Parks of London, who has worked at the Tavistock Clinic and St. Christopher's Hospice. And it does seem a rather long description, and perhaps you won't see it all on the screen, so I'll read it through with you. According to Dr. Murray-Parks, his idea of team approaching care is that care is a matter of human relationships. There are skills to be learned and insight which can be gained from reading books. But the challenge and the reward arises from the fact that demands we use the whole of ourselves to relate to fellow human beings who are in need. And this can only be learned by experience in a community where relationships are fostered, and I would add valued. If you look at the work of the Human Potential Resource Unit, which is a bit of a mouthful, at the University of Surrey in Guildford, much has been done in order to develop understanding of emotional needs. The work of John Heron has stated that essentially when trying to understand how to help people to fulfill their needs, there are possibly three important areas to consider. Until the heat of the day, the acetate's starting to sweat. What Heron has said in terms of helping people during their adjustment is, first of all, our approach should be one. Maybe this is stating the obvious for many of us, but I still think it's worth actually reminding ourselves of what we're seeking through our team approach in order to help people to maximise their potential. The understanding is that the person still needs to be able to give and to receive understanding. And maybe during states of shock or fear or not being quite clear what's happening, that isn't always something very easy to do. To be able to understand what's happening, to be able to express themselves, to be able to grasp reason to feel that they're informed and also to be able to give information. Within the concept of choice, Heron suggests for fulfillment of emotional needs, we need to be able to choose, to be chosen, to make decisions. And how often and how many times do we actually include people in decision making? And also to be able to show our specialness and those qualities that are particular and special about us. And also to be able to constantly be able to demonstrate our abilities. Perhaps when you are challenged by disease, how able do you feel, how confident do you feel to still be able to be doing these things when you're in this transitional stage? And how can we help people to still be able to function at this level when major change is arising for them? The last, probably the most important, that of love. To be able to give love, to be able to receive it, to also be able to receive warmth and affection, appreciation and support. Again, I would say, when we are compromised, when we're in a transition of major loss or major alteration, working towards fulfillment of potential, how much are these emotions suppressed? How can we start to rekindle and liberate them? Heron would go on to suggest that if any of these areas are not satisfied, are not allowed to be ventilated, are not fulfilled, then we start to develop blocks. So that is it is not within our capacity to show what we need, to make our needs known, and to be able to relate and respond to people. So if understanding, love, choice and control are blocked or are not being used to the satisfaction of the person, the results of the blocks can be fear and also stress. And I believe that if fear starts to be overwhelming and stress starts to be overwhelming, our natural healing abilities are further compromised, and perhaps at times the compromise is further supported and endorsed. We become overwhelmed by invasive treatment, and unless we have prepared and adequately monitor people as they're going through treatment, maybe one of the reasons why people do fall foul of treatments or are not able to respond appropriately, maybe one of the reasons is that the amount of fear that they have stored or the stress that the treatment is creating for them almost makes the treatment null and void or has to be prolonged or has to be delayed. It also compromising the very precious immune system. It may lead to poor recovery or minimisation of potential, and in some instances, I believe, premature death. I have a feeling, through talking with people, through my own observations, and maybe analysing what I would feel like and what I have felt like when I've been exposed to major life changes, that the thing that underpins it is a great sense of fear, fear of unknownness, fear of what will happen. And the thing that supports fear and the thing that results of fear is stress. I believe if you look at any of the major emotional reactions that happen to us when we're adjusting to major loss or change, they are all indicators of fear and stress. The work of Professor Hans Selye, as early as the 1940s, and the subsequent work of Garfinkel, Simonton, and all the other well-known writers on stress, have proved, I believe quite conclusively, that unless we manage and control stress, it becomes overwhelming and subsequently becomes life-threatening in itself. And when you look at the work of people who are attempting to reduce stress levels, the work of therapists in relaxation, in all the other complementary therapists, the one thing that underpins their work is attempting to get the person to reharmonize and rebalance their life. And more lately, looking at the work of Dr. Kay Kamani in London, teaching autogenic training to those people who are either HIV positive or have AIDS, he has proved not only the quality but the quantity of their life has been extended. And certainly those young people who have developed Kaposi's sarcoma with an expected lifespan of only 20 odd months, that they are living well beyond that, because I believe that they are managing through self-help, through the releasing their natural healing abilities, the realignment and the reharmonizing of their body has overcome the cancer. The research is now being available. And I think this is wonderful. This is just a gift that's come, and we should be looking more to it. When you look at the actual physical results of stress on the body, and then relate it to somebody who is already compromised by disease or by the treatment of the disease, these are the things that can happen. The effects of stress can be that we fail to use glucose effectively. There is alteration in the way the body metabolizes fat. The thymus gland becomes involuted. There is an inclination to raise coagulation time so the blood is clotting faster. There is a definite proof of resistance, a lowered resistance to infection. There is suppression of our naturally occurring inflammatory response with an inhibition towards granulation. So things just don't heal quickly. And two major points. There is a reduction in the immune system's response and major alterations to mood and emotions. I believe one of our greatest enemies when we're looking after people with cancer is stress and fear, and how much time we need to give to that can only be done on individual assessments. But I do believe that I have seen and I have read and I have known people where stress management techniques have been put in, and the quality and the quantity of that life has almost instantly improved. And this is why it is so important that we go about our assessments on a team approach basis, and that we embrace all and any aspect of a team that can complement and offset this reaction in order for the person to heal themselves or to respond better to their treatment. When I looked at the lovely title, and knowing Stephen as I do, realising the power of caring is very much what Stephen is about, I started to put down care, and then I don't know what you call it when you put the letter and then write a word after it. They didn't educate me after tertiary level. What do you call that when you put a C and then put something else instead of it? You'll have to tell me in a minute. Education wasn't there when I was at school. But when I looked at the word the power of care, I actually just wrote down the word care at the side and started to wonder what it actually meant for me. Maybe the C was representing concern. It also represented commitment. But most of all, in a team approach, it actually meant communication. Have we worked it out what it means yet?
Not yet.
You went to university.
I'm just being ignorant.
When I looked at the word A, I thought it could certainly represent assistance. We're here to assist. I also thought it meant availability, but I couldn't spell availability at lunchtime. Too much brufen. But most of it came out for me was alliance. The R represented rehabilitation and relevance. And when I talk about relevance, I mean how relevant is this management that you're offering to this person and their family or the people that are important to them in their lives? And how much is it for your own convenience? But maybe it was the release of the resources that the R really meant for me. And this is about the person with cancer, releasing their resources. The E, because I'm a teacher, had to stand for education. But it also really meant more to say empowering. So I believe that care is actually communication, alliance, release of resources, and an empowering vehicle at the very best. And putting those together actually came my title of Therapeutic Alliance. And I see that the important thing in a therapeutic alliance is that you make the bonds very tight and very close. And that when you're identifying the tasks and the goals that the person needs to make for themselves, that it's relevant and realistic and meets the needs that they want to meet and satisfy, and that the bonds and the relationships around that are actually for that intention. I believe we can only do this through a holistic assessment. I'm aware that Jill has discussed holistic assessment with you, so I won't come into that. I see it also as not functioning appropriately unless there's a team approach to it. And that none of this will happen unless you're effective in the way you communicate and make your needs known to people. Maybe for me that was just starting with what was on top. The counselling adage of let's start with what's on top. I'd actually like to hear from you now, because I feel that there's an awful lot of experience in the room. And it would be nice now maybe to just get some of your thoughts about some of the thoughts I've placed before you.
I'd like your comment on your point of entry and then further on moving on to blocks. In my own limited experience, I find very much patients coming very early on, just diagnosed, where there is this terrific chaos going, it seems much easier to begin to get in and begin to get some of these things looked at than when it's much later and they've had treatment, had everything, and they're sort of deserted by the medical support group or the support group they've had, and they've got their armour on them. And then they don't want anything shifted, most of them it seems, until some other crisis occurs. So the point of crisis seems the preferably the best point to move in on, where, you know, if you can get another time.
Right.
I don't know if this is what you feel.
Yes. I think perhaps I work on the premise that if you intervene at the point of crisis, there's hopefully an earlier resolution, and that maybe they'll come back to you earlier next time anything goes wrong. I think what we're experiencing when somebody first receives a diagnosis or first starts to suspect that there's something terribly wrong, that all the grief and the shock reactions set in. And this is the time when I think we need to really hold everybody back and just say, let's take time to just settle this. Yes, I know people want instant answers. Can you treat it? Will I get better? Well, am I going to die? And all the other gambit of questions that absolutely overwash them. But I think that it's important not to react too rapidly, because otherwise the choice and control is almost taken out of their hands, really. The cancer is there. Whether you wait one day or a week, it's not going to go away. And I doubt that much else worse will happen in the space of a few extra days. I think that's an important thing for me. I don't know if that was maybe what you were...
I think very much. I just often they're given this anyhow. It's usually 6 weeks before they go on for radiotherapy or whatever. This seems to be an enormously valuable and potentially useful time.
Yes.
Where they have space, they need this time given to them to try and get through this chaos.
Yes.
But the other end, when they've been through it all, then it seems the whole thing gets hard. They've got a fixed way. Many of them have missed.
Yes.
The chance to actually make any good of the whole thing.
Yes.
And they're shut off in their fear and the stress.
Right.
And it seems a much more difficult time than to get in at all.
Yes. My concern is that when they're going through conventional treatments, that there is actually very little offered to them in the way of good informational care and of good counselling. Most of the time it's very prescriptive and a delivery of service, which is very good in many cases, but it is only channeling them one way, and I fear this is when we start to get the blocks, because they become part of a system that they don't understand. And it's very frightening going into places that, particularly with radiotherapy, you're lying there and you're thinking, is this thing going to fall on my head, and are they going to overdose me with the drugs, and all these other weird and horrible fancies that go through your mind. I think it's important that there is some sort of buddying system almost brought into operation at this time, and that there is a key worker once they're in the system. And this is what I feel is lacking, that many people go in for radiotherapy, perhaps more so than chemotherapy, because with chemotherapy very often you have to go into an inpatient unit to have that delivery of service. There are nurses buzzing around, there's probably a chemotherapy nurse specialist who delivers your chemo, you can develop a relationship with her. You can't do that in radiotherapy. Very often there isn't a nurse or any other carer in the radiotherapy department. There's a radiotherapist, but essentially the reason that the patient is there is to receive a certain amount of radiotherapy, and then off they go. They go home. They may have long waits waiting for ambulances. There's nobody to talk about questions to when they get home. And this is when another area I think needs some looking at. In the early stages, maybe we should be pushing and imploring and employing people to act as key workers, those people that can identify the needs at the particular areas that patients are coming into.
I think that's very important, because when I was diagnosed with cancer, there was no one there that I could really talk to how I felt.
Yes.
You know, the doctors were saying, we'll come back in a few weeks and we'll start the radiotherapy or the chemotherapy or what have you. But there was no one no one to counsel me as to how I was feeling. I think that's very important.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Is that one of the roles that women nurses specifically?
Not particularly. I mean, Bridget's sitting there now, but I think essentially no, not at the moment. It's not an organised service. It's coming. There are certain centres in the country where there is someone designated. It might be a nurse, it could be a social worker, who is responsible for assessing and trying to pick up people who potentially will need maybe a little bit more input. But it's really very ill-defined at the moment. We need to encourage the government and local authorities to put money into these funding of these posts. There are liaison nurses that occasionally are attached to oncology clinics and outpatient departments who have the capacity and funding to follow people home, but it's still very, very low key and isn't really seen as a... I think some of these services are still seen, as I'm within the health authority, you haven't heard me say it, I still think it's seen as a luxury. It's not just Torbay, it's nationwide. It's like counselling.
Could you expand a little bit on what you mean by the team? Who is included in the team?
I think anybody that's important to the person who has cancer. I mean, if I'm looking at a professional team, I think the one thing we have to avoid is having too many professional people in, because I think that creates confusion and it actually takes the focus away from the patient. It takes it onto the specialist and their particular bit. I think importantly, I suppose I have this mental picture of people standing with holding each other's hands in a circle. I used to do diagrams of putting the person and his family in the middle of the circle and putting professionals like a wagon train all the way around. I don't do that anymore because I think at any one time we need to establish that it's equal, and if there isn't equal responsibility, then it's not a team, it's a hierarchy.
The patient is part of the team.
The patient is holding the hands as well. Whoever that might be, it could be people from backgrounds of nursing, doctoring, physioing, or aromatherapy, massage, AT, whatever, psychology. It doesn't really matter who they are, as long as they're relevant and not a circus.
But at the minute we have a professional team and we have the complementary team. Do you think the time will ever come and we can work towards sort of merging these two for the benefit of the...
I personally don't see any difference. I don't discriminate between...
No, you don't and I don't.
No.
There is discrimination.
There is discrimination, but I think what I have to ask myself with anybody who's caring for somebody or assisting them in their recovery and their realigning is, are they safe? It must be safe practice, you do no harm. Whether you're a doctor, a nurse or acupuncturist, you do no harm, that's what we're here for. Let's break down barriers.
There's almost a need, though, for the non-professional person to be there as a support to the individual and their family. Mm. And this is sort of the angle where I come in.
Mm-hmm.
I have spent some time with a cancer support group in another part of the country that was associated with Bristol. But I began to realise that, in fact, I always wanted it to feel that it wasn't just for cancer, that there is a general need for the non-professional person to be there as a buddy, as you just said. Yes. Someone to whom they can come and talk or ring up at any time of the day or night.
Yes.
If they feel afraid.
Yes, that's so vitally important because it's bringing the importance of the community back in. I think that with our science and technology being so sophisticated, we've almost de-skilled ourselves, and that we haven't actually taken into account that the advancement of science and technology is wonderful, but it hasn't actually brought human frailty along with it. human frailty cannot be pushed into a wall and have £20 dished out after it. And there's that lovely story that Mel Brooks tells. He's ringing his mother in Brooklyn, and he rings her and he says, she says, "Oh, hello Mel, how are you?" And so he said, "Oh, I've had a good day, I've been okay, I've seen my analyst today." So she said, "An analyst? What's an analyst?" He says, "Well, you go and see them and you lie down and maybe you have a coffee and you tell them your worries and they maybe help you work through those worries. Then you get up and you go home." And she said, "Oh, you mean a good neighbour?" We're all valuable, really. Yes. It's just we shouldn't get too drunk on our power structures.
When you talk about team, are you, do you still feel that there needs to be a division of labour? Realistically, people do have different skills.
Yes.
My worry is that if we start allocating workers who then provide the counselling, it's colluding with a system which in part allows other people to disengage from that completely.
Yes.
And provide you with your dose of rads or your dose of chemotherapy or whatever it is.
Yes.
And isn't it the case that in a sense everybody in the team has got to start equaling out what it is they're able to contribute?
Yes. Yes, it's setting
they
realistic.
They can't do it realistically, they can't all do it in terms of technical skills.
Yes. Yes, I think it's realistic goal setting, and I think this is why people have to actually sit around and talk about why there should be realistic goal setting, because it's very easy, I think, for one person to either take it all or to imagine they can deliver it all at the expense of losing some very special skill over there. So yes, I think it has to be equalised. I think maybe I realise that this may not be a very sensitive thing to say, but I think we have to move away from the medically dominated approach to care. And when I talk about medical, I'm not looking at doctors particularly, I'm just looking at everyone that happens to carry a handle of doctor, nurse or whatever, psychiatrist, psychologist. I think we have to be moving into person-centred care, not professional status care. Do you know what I mean?
I if think somebody has a diagnosis of cancer, my presumption is they would very much need to have somebody with medical care as their responsibility, even if you choose to go outside that field, personal support.
Yes.
I guess most of us with one hand would hang on very tight to that medical model too.
Yes.
And we reward that with additions.
Yes, and I think we have to recognise that our natural healing abilities and our natural abilities as healers, whether we heal with our words, whether we heal with our touch, or whether we heal with our technology, is recognised. Maybe some of the way our healing is used is by qualifying us as a doctor or qualifying us as a skilled worker. It's striking the balance, isn't it? There is a very definite need for services. There is a very definite need for certain managements of treatment.
I just say with reference to that in my own case that what I was looking for, once I realized that the easy direct orthodox approach that was available to me didn't look like it was going to lead me anywhere. At that stage I was looking for someone not so much with the right kind of credentials as someone with a track record. If it had been some holy man on a Greek island, I would have gone there. I mean, as long as someone I knew could inform me that they had helped one or two people that I could check up on, and I knew there was something that worked. I didn't much mind what context it was at that stage, although my first response, obviously, was to call the doctor.
I don't don't think we can ever ignore any potential that can help us to get better. Whether that's the surgeon's life, radiotherapy, chemotherapy, diet therapy, whatever. It is being sensible about the balance, really, and not going from one end of the spectrum to the other and ignoring what's actually available. But it's as long as they know the spectrum.
Here's what's so successful, so many other people think it might be, about Bristol. The fact that it has a lot of different disciplines, team, call it what you will, under one roof.
Yes.
So that you actually go and treated by as a whole person in this one place, rather than our normal system where you have psychologists in one place, surgeons in another place, possibly even physicians in another place. Yes. It's also
a team. It's a team, and even if maybe at times they aren't even aware of each other. Because the link between the team is the person with cancer.
And the fact that that particular team does cover the whole range and does bring in people from complementary therapies, yes, etc.,
yes,
which isn't available normally.
Yes, I still go back to the idea that it has to be safe. We have a responsibility to ensure that the person with cancer, whatever they're seeking, it's safe, sound, wholesome practice. Because maybe if you're in a jumble, you need someone to say, you may be going down the right road, but let's just stop for a minute, because you're the objective observer. It's if maybe your objective observation takes you to lead them down a road which maybe is just for your needs and not theirs.
Is coronavirus, because if you're on a hospital ward and there's a patient with cancer who is very, very confused and getting more confused by the minute by seeing different consultants and possibly a registrar, is there any outside influence that could come in? I know the Macmillan Minister can do a wonderful job, but is there anyone else that can come in out from outside and just sit or talk to the patient and listen to his story?
There's always the invitation to invite people. Maybe what you're hoping for is that the people who are working within that department, that unit, are aware of the jumble that might be presented to them. You hope that there is an advocate somewhere within that clinical team, and this is what we're working towards, particularly in nurse education. Because perhaps when you're an inpatient, it's the nurse who's there in one form or another, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for as long as it can be. It's really just providing the opportunity to say to the patient, we have information to give you, because most people are confused because they don't understand. Maybe we should be saying to people and educating ourselves and each other about, don't let go if you don't understand. Because maybe they think they've told you. And maybe you haven't heard because you're stressed and you're shocked and you can't hear. Maybe it's because you've been catapulted into it in the first place. It really has to be about educating people not to just take what's delivered and to say, I'm lost, I don't understand.
Yes, I was thinking that very much, that it's important to be able to encourage people to ask questions. And when you get the news like this, for a bit you're rather blank, taking in, dealing with yourself or your friend, or dealing with all the implications. But if you have a good doctor or nurse with you who gives you the space and also says, is there anything you'd like to ask? Are you informed about this, that and the other? I mean, whether it's diet, it is first of all education, then making information available and being able to encourage the patient
to ask the questions, find out what they need for their own support system, for their own selves.
Yes.
It's the questions, yes. Being yes. free. And yes. I've noticed that the people we've seen here and in America during the last 2.5 years of the professionals, nurses and lady doctors and therapists will always ask us questions and ask dumb questions. They're very interested in the story. And the male doctors, on the whole, don't ask him very many questions about what's happened or what he thinks happened and what's been fruitful. It's yes. as if they're not always very willing to readjust their model or to expand their right. information system.
Yes.
That struck me very much, that those who will ask questions, I mean both the patients and also the therapists, medical team, who will ask questions, go a bit further with things.
Yes, I think it's interesting as well that the latest statistics tell us that 97% of the nursing profession is female, so there ought to be a lot of talking going on. I don't know what the statistics are with doctors, actually.
I wonder what the statistics would be, the number of, the proportion of nurses that are in fact student nurses, who on the whole are young, on the whole are fairly inexperienced and nice. Yes. And I know from personal experience that actually it's quite difficult when you're on a ward and you're actually carrying out a very responsible task.
Yes.
Seeing things you've never seen in your life before.
Yes.
Including having to face up to another person's death and possibly looking at your own.
Yes. Yes.
And I think, you know, the vast proportion of nursing is done by students.
Yes. Who rely heavily on that role modelling. Maybe the encouraging thing about nurse education is that I believe that it is moving very heavily and very forcefully into demanding a holistic model. I can say that with great truth and conviction, that we are moving towards a holistic model. The problems that it's facing is the structure is trying to do it with it. Well, crumbling in as much as the fact that the health service is in a very great state of transition. But secondly, it's doing it within a structure that is so thoroughly technically orientated. And when you're talking about holism, you're talking about the whole person, person-centred care. And that doesn't necessarily fit too comfortably in with test tubes and instant results and instant cures.
I get the feeling it's much more difficult with that approach within a hospital than if you are working within a community where you have, as we have in top nurses, care at home, which is very successful. It seems to be much easier to get close to people in that environment,
yes,
than in a hospital where you have forces actually working against you. You have lack of time because you have other patients, and you have the medical side of it, which sometimes can work against you trying to get close.
Yes.
You know, time to listen and close to the patient.
Yes, I think the other thing as well is that we need to provide within our education system, and I use the word education very, very broadly, whoever is educating or influencing or facilitating, that when you're moving towards holistic care, you cannot start that journey until you've already got deeply in touch with who you are and done a lot of work on self-awareness. And I do not think the system tolerates that. I mean, that's the work that I'm doing. And I know, I've just been with a group today, and you know that they're desperate to just get rid of all the shackles and restraints and want to move forward. but there are so many restraints that you wonder, where do you start? And I suppose what you just have to say is that, I think it was John F. Kennedy that said the journey of 1,000 miles starts with 1 foot forward. I think we have to start to give people permission to be frail and to get involved and to take time to assess and treat holistically. Because I do believe that basically mankind is screaming out for that. And when you see the wonderful way support groups come together, ordinary people, ordinary lives, just embracing each other because they care. You know, this is so important. And I think that nurses, doctors are the same people, but maybe the way that we have trained them, conditioned them, pressurized them, they're almost screaming deep from in, for heaven's sake, let it come out. Just let me be who I want to be with this person. I'll take the risk of getting involved. And if it hurts me, that's all right. Because hopefully there'll be somebody there to hold on to me when it hurts.
There's an old Chinese proverb that I was informed of weakness of, which has become my favorite and seems to apply to almost everything I'm interested in these days. And it's simply, when the people lead, the leaders follow.
Yes.
So I think sessions like this are marvelous because it allows more and more people to take that individual responsibility. And eventually the stuck in the mud leaders will be forced to follow.
I could not continue in the work I'm doing without knowing the changes that I see in people as a result of a course or being given the chance to explore for themselves what's happening. And although we say, ain't it awful and aren't they dreadful, there is a small but powerful worker force that started that 1,000-mile journey. All we've got to do is just keep saying what it feels like to be on the receiving end of them and applaud them and tell them it's okay. You're going to fall on your face and make terrible mistakes, but you get up and you start all over again. Because we've forgotten how to care. We've been so utterly disturbed as a society and a culture since the Second War particularly. Changes came obviously after the First War and before. I mean, if you told your grandparents, your great-grandparents, that we'd be walking on the moon by 1965, they would have locked you in the broom cupboard for telling lies, wouldn't they? And yet from 1900 to 1965, which is only three generations maybe? No, not three generations, we think it's 25 years a generation. That we would have not only walked on the moon, we would have already pioneered wonderful drugs that can stop our children dying of infectious diseases. But the very things we learned to kill men with, i.e. weapons, and then sent them back to the fronts with a crunch in their nails so they could go back and try and die again in the trenches, which we now heal people's femurs with. And if we didn't get bombed out of the sea with the U-boats on the North Atlantic, we wouldn't have ultrasound. Think of all the devastation we've had in order to resurrect life. Little wonder we're shocked. We're shell-shocked with what we've done. And a doctor and a nurse and a physio and a psychologist, psychiatrist or anything, a carer, an acupuncturist, they're no different. They've gone through the same evolution patterns as we've gone through. It's just that maybe we expect different things from them.
I was just going to say, are there any more questions from the audience? Because I want to save your voice.
I was only going to talk for 20 minutes. Sorry.
Are there any more? One final question. Okay, well, I would like to extend a very big thank you to Teresa for that. I mean, it was a lot of effort to actually make it along here and keep on your feet for longer than 20 minutes an hour. And on behalf of everyone else here, thanks very much indeed. Thank you.